Across Europe and the Middle East, America's reputation can be a complicated mix of scorn and fear. Join us as Pulitzer Prize winner and New York Times journalist Alyssa Rubin reflects on her decades-long career as a reporter and on the American image abroad, from Paris to Baghdad. Alyssa Rubin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for asking me.
I've been thinking about your career, the arc of your career since Brown, really. I think you tell stories about real people, but that also tell a larger story, whether it's a woman who wants to be a suicide bomber and a woman who can't go home because her family will kill her, and what that means about her society and what that means about the geopolitical forces affecting her country. And I wonder, you were a classics minor and a Renaissance studies major, and I just wonder if that training sort of helps you think about story or the human story differently?
That's an interesting question. I think the thing it most gave me was a sense of a kind of oral history and tradition that is very deeply embedded in our Western society, but that is true also in not-so-Western societies.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
A kind of storytelling that is part of a longer, almost social or societal story, so that as you listen to someone from a war today in Iraq, you can almost make yourself hear back through the centuries, back through, you know, British invasions or colonial periods, back beyond that. This is in my mind, particularly right now, because I just was recently back in Iraq, and I was in the Nineveh Plain, which is in the north of Iraq, and it's where the tablets, which had the poem Gilgamesh, were ultimately found, I think in the 18th century. What we're telling is always part of a much bigger story of a people in a place, and each place holds many histories. And so I'm always very aware of that. I go back over and over again to the beginning of Boccaccio's Decameron. I think it should be required in every journalism school, because it has a description of what it was like when the plague descended. At one point, they stop ringing the bells because there are so many dead that they cannot They can't just ring them all day, you know, all day and all night.
Oh my God.
And the smell of it, and the look of the pustules, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And that's when people ask me, well, you know, what do you need to do when you're doing journalism? I always think you have to describe that as viscerally and mm-hmm. clearly as you can. Mm-hmm. And so that is very much part of how I think about what I do, and also the idea of original text. I did my undergraduate thesis. It was something that had not been, it was letters from one Renaissance humanist to another, which had not been previously translated from Latin into English. And it gave a little window on what life was like. And I think, you know, that's always what we're looking for, mm-hmm. the original text. In our case, it's not text. It's going to the real person and finding out what they think.
Mm-hmm.
But it functions in a similar way as having a certain authenticity that you can't get with commentaries or mm-hmm. Sort of secondary sources.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you say that, because I read your story about the murder of the woman whose name is now escaping me.
Farkunda.
And then I clicked on another link, and it was the video, and I didn't watch the video because I didn't need to. First of all, it was horrifyingly upsetting, but also I had it all in my head from reading you. But just to back up a little bit, how did you go from being a Renaissance studies classics scholar at Brown to modern European history, I believe, at Columbia, to a newspaper writer?
Well, in bits and pieces, I guess, would be the answer. After I finished at Brown, did not speak Italian. My work was all in Latin. And yet, one of the great themes and stories of the Renaissance is the development of the vernacular. And so I thought, well, I did all this study of Italy and I don't even speak Italian. I ought to go and learn it. So I enrolled in a language program and went to Italy. And I really fell in love with being overseas. I just felt like I was awake all the time. You know what? When you're a little kid, if you ever go to a relative's house, how big it seems, you know, like going to, for me, it was going to my grandmother's on Christmas vacation. And when I ultimately came home, I thought, I need to find a job where I can live overseas. And then I thought, well, what I really like to do is write. So I need to find someone who will pay me to write overseas. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be able to make a living doing that. I started to work in journalism then as a fact checker for a publication in New York initially. And then I decided, well, you know, that wasn't such a good idea. And in fact, I want to go back to academia. And I was very lucky and I got a Mellon Fellowship in the Humanities to go to graduate school. Uh-huh. So that's when I went to Columbia and I did my work in modern European history. And then I once again felt not terribly happy and I thought I didn't want to live my life in a library and I wasn't helping people. And so I finished my master's and I got into the PhD program, but instead I decided to take all my money and go to South Africa and see if I really liked to be in a place where I didn't know anyone and try to do some research on a topic. Because I thought, well, that's what you do if you're a foreign correspondent. It was really a transformative experience. I'd never seen anything like it. I felt just constantly filled with questions and learning all the time. And so after that, I knew that I was on the right track. But I had this problem, which was that I really didn't know a thing about journalism. Because I had read newspapers, of course, but I hadn't ever thought about how news got there. It was like milk. It appears on the shelf, you know.
How did you learn?
Well, I just applied to newspapers. And after, I think I applied to 45 papers without getting a job. And eventually, a very kind man who was the assistant managing editor of the Charlotte Observer, and he said, you know, we just would not hire you. You have no experience. But there's another Knight Ridder paper which just lost a lot of its staff in a union fight, and maybe they would hire you. And that was where I ultimately got a first job.
And that was Wichita.
That was Wichita.
Oh, mm-hmm. My gosh.
And for me, that was like a foreign assignment. I was a New Yorker. I'm from a fairly long line of New Yorkers. I had been in the Colorado once. I'd never been to California. I didn't own a car. I hadn't been to a mall or a McDonald's. Wow. I grew up in New York before there were a lot of McDonald's. Uh-huh. And so I went, and then I guess I have a penchant for falling in love with places, and I loved Kansas. Mm. And I didn't expect to. But I ended up really liking it, and I stayed 4 years.
Wow.
And then that helped me get to Washington, and then that in turn ultimately helped me get to a paper which had a foreign desk.
The LA Times.
Right.
You were sort of an autodidact in the
journalism sense, I suppose, yes.
Did you get better and better just by getting better and better, or did you have a mentor? Did you just read other people whose stories you admired?
I mean, the first person who inspired me was in my first journalism job. It was a man named Steve Brill, who started a publication called American Lawyer. In the period when I worked as his fact checker, it was very early days. He was doing very bold stuff, and he had a very daring mind. He asked questions and just sort of dared you to try to come up with the answer. Wow. And I was just a fact checker. I wasn't anyone important. I wasn't writing stories, but I was around really brilliant journalists, and almost everyone really went on to remarkable journalism careers. He really had a sense for smart reporting, mm-hmm. and rigorous reporting. Mm-hmm. And I think I liked that rigor, just like I liked Latin. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about this notion of fake news. that I'm afraid we're getting used to, which I hope we never do. I hope it's always shocking to us that that accusation can be made. When the president says fake news, fake news, fake news, is it enough that you know about the integrity of your work and your colleagues at the Times? Or do you feel that there's something that can be proven or should be proven or some answer to that?
I guess I certainly don't take it personally in any way. I think that it is raising a lot of questions about standards and also judgment. And one of our real deficits in the electronic media age is that our capacity to both generate news and information, because they're a little bit, you know, different but related, and stories, is so much faster than our ability to absorb it and evaluate it.
Mm-hmm.
And there has not been an effort, sort of socially and intellectually, to teach people how to decide whether something is more or less true,
mm-hmm.
more true or less true. And that is what really needs to happen in the society. The, you know, I think that the New York Times, for instance, or a number of other publications do extremely legitimate, careful work, but it's based on criteria and standards that are not widely understood publicly, and that's our fault.
Mm.
And we need to teach people what those are, mm-hmm. at every level. There's an old colleague of mine from the Los Angeles Times who started something called the News Literacy Project, which mm-hmm. is really fascinating. They go into schools and teach kids how to evaluate what they read or see on the internet. You know, how do you know something might be true or might be false?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's this enormous explosion of information and news stories and no real understanding of how it's put together that has been really deleterious mm-hmm. for the profession.
Well, and that leads me to another question, and that is social media. Has that changed how you report a story or how you are as a journalist?
Social media is a tool, mm-hmm. and it's useful for journalism as it is for many other things, and it is deceptive for journalism as it is deceptive for many other things.
How is it useful?
Well, it's very useful because if you're trying to find somebody, you can put a note on Facebook.
To the world.
You can search Facebook for mm-hmm. stuff. But it's also very useful for understanding the zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. And I need to know what people are interested in or what their assumptions are. And I might not know that. I might not talk to people like many of the people who are out there reading what I write. It's important for me to think and see the way they think and then think about how I can help them see what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm. So it sometimes informs what you choose to write about? Or how
I wouldn't. Well, sometimes we literally write about what is appealing to people on social media. It's one. It has become one of many criteria to look at whether an idea has a certain currency.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can overrate it. You have to really bring a lot of critical faculties mm-hmm. to figuring out how much attention you want to pay to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, certainly, I believe, and I'm happy the Times believes, that there are stories that don't get a lot of attention in the paper, but that we need to write anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Although you have to have a certain number of readers to make it a going concern.
Right.
So it's a balance between those two.
Right. It's tricky. It sounds tricky. I was thinking about your posting in Paris 3 years ago.
I started in 2013, yeah.
And I was just thinking in those few years, so many things have happened. I mean, I didn't used to think of Paris as...
No, Paris has become really a very busy European capital, and our bureau is really busy.
Yeah, with the Paris attacks, the Brussels attacks.
Right. And attacks really Nice. I mean,
Nice,
the Talis attack that failed. It goes on and on.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And then Macron.
Yeah, Macron.
President Macron is a phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
Both in Europe and I think in the larger sort of Western oriented world.
How do the states look from where you sit in Paris?
Well, certainly you know, they're going in the opposite direction. And that's puzzling to me as both as an American and as a visiting sort of a European resident right now, mm-hmm. because I don't really understand why the government right now sees the world so differently. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm an American and we're often out of step with the world as a country.
Mm-hmm. One final question I have is over the past decade of your reporting from Iraq and Afghanistan and Paris, have you noticed a change in how the U.S. is perceived? I guess it depends on where you were in the world, but let's say the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference in perception when there's an Obama in office, when there's a Bush in office?
No, is the answer. If you look at American foreign policy in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, which are the two theaters I've spent the most time in, they've been remarkably consistent. Obama was very intent on getting out of the war and that in Iraq, and that was disapproved of, disliked, resented by the Iraqis. Much as when George Bush got into the war there, it was disliked and disapproved of by a significant number of the Iraqis, though certainly a significant number welcomed it, both the sort of plurality Shiites and the Kurds. But America is, it is really hard to come out on the winning side of people's hearts when part of what you do is bombing mm-hmm. and shooting people. Mm-hmm. So you will help make some people happy, but you will almost always alienate others. And that's just the way war works, mm-hmm. regrettably.
And given that that dim view exists, did that ever affect access or how you were treated as a journalist?
No, I have to say, everywhere I have worked has my lasting, lifelong admiration for people really saying over and over again, I know you are not your government. And that's a very hard thing for them to say, because in their country, often the media and the government go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
But many people have actually, I think, begun to learn that. The people who always are suspicious of it, actually, are often people who aren't from the country themselves.
Alyssa Rubin, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or download us on your favorite podcasting app. If you like us, rate us, and help others who might enjoy the show find us. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.